If I hadn't have opened the door that night, I might have survived the week alone. I arrived at the cabin late in the afternoon. The sky was rumbling with dark clouds. My mother had just passed away, and I needed time away from everyone. The forest surrounding the cabin was vast and silent. The isolation was intense, but that's exactly why I chose this place. The sky was rumbling with dark clouds. That night, a storm hit. The wind howled, lashing at the trees and shaking the windows. The thunder cracked so loudly I thought it might split the roof. Lying in bed with a heavy heart, memories of my mother raced through my mind. Suddenly, I heard a knock. At first, I thought it was just the tree branches, but soon the knocking changed into thudding. Someone was desperately hitting my door with their fists. A little nervous, I swung my legs off the bed, my mind struggling to understand who could be at this hour. I thought I was the only one here. I opened the door and found a man, soaked to the bone. His hair was clinging to his forehead. Bloodstains on his shirt were so big that it didn't go unnoticed. He looked like he'd been through hell. Fumbling in fear, he said,
"My wife, we crashed near the creek. She's hurt, unconscious. This was the only house with lights on."
I didn't hesitate. Grabbing my raincoat and flashlight, I followed him into the night. We reached the wreckage just by the creek. The car skidded off the road and into a shallow ditch. Inside, a woman lay unconscious, blood oozing from her head. She wasn't moving. My chest tightened, and without a word, the man and I pulled her from the wreckage and carried her back to the cabin. I disinfected her wound, bandaged it as best as I could, and tucked her into my bed. The man changed into my dry clothes. With a storm raging outside, the cabin must have felt like a rescue to the poor guy. I poured us both a glass of wine, trying to ease the tension that hung in the air. I broke the silence. "How did the accident happen?" The man took a sip, and then his story began. He said they were visiting her parents. The more he spoke, I started seeing inconsistencies in his story. His words seemed to drift, and his eyes flickered with confusion as if he couldn't remember simple details. Maybe he's traumatized by the accident, I thought.
"I need rest,"
he suddenly said, rising from his chair. He walked into the bedroom, leaving me alone in the living room. I felt a growing unease, but I tried to brush it off. I locked the front door and settled on the couch, hoping to get some sleep. I don't recall the exact time, but I felt hot breath over my face. My eyes snapped open. A woman was standing over me. I realized it was the wife of that man. Her hair was still damp, clinging to her pale face, her eyes wide and unblinking. I nearly screamed, but she quickly pressed her hand over my mouth.
"Please, don't scream,"
she begged, her breath hot against my ear. I nodded, frozen with fear, asked,
"Do you want me to call your husband? Are you feeling okay?"
She leaned in close, her voice shaking as she spoke.
He's not my husband."
I stared at her in disbelief, my heart pounding in my chest.
"What?"
"Call the cops,"
she muttered in a shaken voice. I grabbed my phone, but there was no signal. The storm must have knocked out the tower. Panic bubbled up in me.
"We need to get to the police station,"
I whispered.
"He has a knife,"
she murmured. I nodded grimly, realizing the nightmare. My car keys were in the bedroom with the man. With my heart in my throat, I cracked open the bedroom door, my pulse hammering in my ears. The man was asleep, his breathing slow and steady. His damp clothes were scattered around the room, and there, on the nightstand, were the keys, gleaming faintly in the dim light. I took a deep breath and stepped inside, every footfall a potential alarm. The floor creaked beneath my feet. I froze. The man shifted in his sleep, groaning softly, but thankfully he didn't wake. I held my breath as I tiptoed toward the nightstand, my hands shaking as I reached for the keys. Suddenly, the man rolled over, and my heart nearly stopped. I ducked, my entire body tense, my hand clenching the keys. The man exhaled sharply, but mercifully, he didn't wake. I crept backward, every muscle screaming, and shut the door behind me with a soft click. I grabbed the woman's hand, and together we bolted for the front door. I unlocked it, and we ran blindly into the storm, sprinting for the car. The drive was a blur. The rain lashed at the windshield, and the wipers struggled to keep up with the downpour. The woman sobbed quietly beside me, her breath hitching in the darkness. I didn't stop until I saw the flickering lights of the county police station. The officers took her statement. One of them made a call for backup, and they raced to the cabin. But the man was gone. No sign of him anywhere. No struggle, just the woman's blood, dried on my bedsheets, and a broken wine glass. The next morning, an officer sat me down.
"He's a known stalker, Robert Walsh," the officer said. "Escaped custody 2 weeks ago. You're lucky to be alive."
The woman thanked me, and her family thought I did some heroic deed that night. But honestly, I did what a sensible human being would have done. I pray to God every single day that the man gets caught. As a solo hiker, I finished the last mile with a sort of breathless excitement. The trail wound up through the trees, opening at the top into a desolate, beautiful quiet. The wind, the needle of the pines, and the long drop past the cliff edge made me choose the spot at my campsite. I was at the perfect place to witness the full sunrise next morning. By the time the sun dropped behind the distant ridge, I was done setting my tent and starting a fire. Sharpening a sturdy twig with my knife, I started roasting my steak on the fire. The sky above me soon got filled with billions of stars. I had a great time for next 4 hours straight. Around 10:30 p.m., I zipped myself into my sleeping bag, imagining the dreamy sunrise I'm about to witness in some hours. I fell asleep. At exactly 2:36 a.m., I woke up, but not because of the sunrise. There were voices outside. Then, I heard slow, deliberate footsteps followed by dragging sound.
"It's getting heavier with each step. We should have buried it down somewhere."
"Shut up. You always take the easy way out."
I didn't move or even breathe. My heart started hammering in my chest, louder than their steps. I slid forward, inch by inch, until I could peek through the half-zipped gap on my tent. Two people were out there, a man and a woman. They must be in their mid-30s or so. They were dragging something heavy, like a duffel bag.
"We're almost close to the edge,"
the woman whispered.
"Careful now,"
the man answered, low and quiet.
"Spinal cord's already shattered. One good toss and he's gone."
I couldn't move, couldn't breathe. Only one clear thought kept rising in my head. Are they dumping a body? They suddenly stopped. The woman looked up and scanned the trees. Her eyes seemed to linger. She said,
"You sure we're alone?"
The man cocked his head to the side, almost lazily.
"Thought I'd heard something."
I flinched back into the tent like a reflex, hands over my mouth. I froze there, skin crawling, heart thudding so loud it felt like they'd hear it. The air felt thicker suddenly, dense, wrong. A twig snapped outside, closer than before. I prayed to God that the couple didn't see my tent. After a slight pause, the dragging sound began once again, and I felt my blood flowing again. I peeked again from the gap and saw the couple facing their back at me. Taking this opportunity, I slowly crawled out and quickly moved behind a boulder. Even though my tent was behind a tree, I knew it's not safe anymore to stay inside. From there, I watched them move to the cliff's edge, lifting the bag together. They didn't hesitate for a second, just heaved and let it fall. A wet thud echoed in the valley. It probably fell into the river, and once again, silence prevailed. The man and the woman looked down like little kids throwing rocks at a stream. Then they looked at each other. In that glistening moonlight, I watched them smile. Then, as if he'd felt me watching, he turned to the boulder and our eyes locked for a fraction of seconds. "I know you're watching us," he said, calm and casual. I didn't wait. My legs moved before my mind caught up, and I started to run. I bolted uphill, pushing through the trees. My boots hit dirt hard. Branches scraped my arms and face, but I didn't stop. Behind me, flashlights blinked on, cutting through the dark. The woman's voice came after me.
"Wait, it's not what you think. We've a lot of money. Just talk to us. Stop!"
I didn't look back. I cut left into thicker trees, hoping to lose them in terrain that they didn't know. But deep down, I knew that they knew these woods way better than me. I suddenly tripped and went down hard, mud in my mouth, knees torn apart, but I got up again. I'm not letting these killers dump a second body down that edge. I kept moving, kept pushing. Suddenly, a branch cracked to my right. I realized she was circling me. They were splitting up and hurting me. I doubled back, heading for the ridge trail that wound toward the lot where I'd left my car hours earlier. That trail felt like my only shot. Then, something hit me. I felt a hot, sharp sting in my thigh. A rock, maybe, or a knife. I gasping, but didn't cry. I quickly rolled into a shallow ditch, pressed my body flat against the ground so they can't see me. Echoes of aimless footsteps passed inches above me.
"How could you let him go?"
the woman growled. The man's voice stayed even.
"I don't think he saw her face clearly. Let's leave."
I heard them move on, fast and silent like predators. When I got sure that they're gone, I crawled out of the ditch and limped downhill. By the time I saw the dirt road through the thinning trees, the sky had shifted from black to pale yellow. "What a magnificent sunrise," I uttered in my head. My car sat like a lifeline in the distance, faint in the growing light. I didn't hesitate, and I ran, limping, stumbling, gasping for breath, but I ran. Every time I looked back, I feared to see the murderous couple chasing me, but they weren't there anymore. I took my keys out, which I luckily took with me before leaving the tent. Fumbling and cursing, I jammed the first key into the lock, flung open the door, and fell into the driver's seat. I kept clicking to start the car when suddenly a face slammed into the passenger window. It was a man. His eyes were wide and wild, blood on his hands, a knife gleaming in one of them. He didn't yell or rage. He just smiled and said something inaudible. I shoved the key in the ignition and turned with a force. Finally, the car roared. The engine caught, tires spun, and gravel flew. I didn't even check the mirrors as I sped, but as I hit the bend, I caught one last look. They were standing in the dust, both of them, not chasing or waving. They were just standing and watching. I didn't stop driving until I reached the ranger station, maybe an hour later, maybe more. I don't remember, as I could barely talk when I stumbled in, blood down my leg, and my face scratched raw. But I told them everything, every word. When they made it back to the cliff, there was nothing at all. No bodies or blood, just my brand new tent, slashed with knife, boot prints, and long bloody drag marks toward the edge was found. I gave my full report and stayed for hours answering questions. Till today, there's no missing persons, no arrests, and no follow-ups. The bus screeched to a halt in the middle of nowhere. The brakes wheezed like a dying animal. I stepped out into the cool mountain air, took it in, and instantly felt eyes on me. Milena and Goran Karovic were standing a little too still, with smiles a little too wide. A lean, pale girl who looked like she has just recovered from prolonged sickness stood beside them. Her vacant, dark eyes kept scanning me.
"Welcome, Amira. We are Mr. and Mrs. Karovic, and this is our daughter, Anna."
Her voice thick with an accent that wrapped around my name like fog.
"Hope you have a nice time here."
The house was old. The wood of its bones creaked beneath my feet. I noted there were no mirrors on the walls, no clocks, only the scents of herbs and of something decaying, lurking underneath like meat left to rot on the counter. Dinner was awkward and heavy, the kind of food that sits in your stomach like a boulder. Mr. Karovic kept tapping his fingers the entire time we ate. It was making me annoyed, but I had to pretend with a smile. Milena pressed a cup of tea into my hands after dinner.
You sleep now. Tomorrow we show you the village.
I didn't want to drink it, but I promised myself I'll let go of my worries and enjoy my first solo eye trip. I was dead asleep when sounds of hushed voices woke me up. At first, I thought I was dreaming, but then the words took shape, something low, guttural, rising and falling like a chant. I tiptoed to my door and crouched down to look out from the keyhole. The hallway was dark, except for some candlelight, and in that light, I saw them. Milena and Goron circling Anna, forcing something into her mouth and chanting. They were chanting in that creepy language, and it made my skin crawl. I must have coughed or made a noise, because they stopped and turned towards my door. But I held my breath until my lungs burned, and eventually, after many agonizing seconds, the chanting began again. Next morning, everything felt back normal again. Milena hummed while frying bread in pork fat, acting like nothing had happened. They even took me to a tour of the village, but it turned out to be quite disappointing to me. The empty streets, shutters pulled down on almost every window, no kids playing on the streets, made me even more doubtful. Did I choose the wrong host? Back in my room, I began looking for answers. I examined the space around me, trying to find proof of travelers before me who had stopped to stay with the Karovics. One drawer in the nightstand was stuck, and after a few moments of struggling with it, I finally managed to pull it out hard enough to pop it free. Inside was a stack of the same student-like photos of people like me, smiling faces beaming from a time when the world didn't look down on them with their fears of the future or obligations. As I flipped the stack, the pictures kept getting worse and worse, with their features becoming washed out like wet paint smeared over canvas. When I reached the last photo, just Milena, grinning, her eyes black as pitch, and written below, "She carries us all." My hands shook, and I realized something's very wrong going on here. That night, I spoke to Mr. Karovic.
A few responsibilities came, hence I have to leave early.
While forcing a smile, his grin widened.
"Sure," he said, slippery like his voice. "Maybe you should go to bed early, to wake up early."
After a lot of struggle, I finally fell asleep at around 1 a.m. that night. In my sleep, I dreamt of Anna standing over my bed and her eyes glowing in the dark. I woke up choking, my sheets damp and covered in small, muddy handprints. I grabbed my phone, flipping the camera to face me, but the screen glitched. In the picture, my reflection stared back, but half my face was wrong. A second mouth stretched beside mine, another eye blinking just above my cheekbone. I dropped the phone with a gasp, but when I looked again, the image was gone, but I knew what I'd seen. Suddenly, a sound of chanting came again, this time louder, pulling me like a fish on a hook. I followed, creeping through the house and out into the cold. Behind the barn, torches burned in a stone circle, the villagers standing silent and watching. Anna stood in the center, her body limp and her eyes empty. Just then, Milena addressed the villagers, pointing at me.
"Her youth is strong,"
she murmured, stepping forward.
"She can carry too. Bring her."
Hands grabbed me, dragging me into the circle where Goron smeared ash and crushed bone on my forehead. His breath hot in my ear said,
"One gives, one takes, one stays."
The world tilted. My limbs turned to lead and my vision doubled. Anna's face swam in front of me. And then I felt her inside me. A second heartbeat, a whisper in my skull that said,
"Let go. Be one."
But then I saw Anna's tears. They were real, terrified. I knew she didn't want this. I lunged, knocking over the bowl of fire. The embers exploded, screams tearing through the night. I ran, branches clawing at my skin, their howls chasing me.
You must carry us. We are nothing without you.
Milena shrieked. That's when I finally saw some headlights cut through the trees. A postal van. I stumbled into the road, my ankles screaming, my breath ragged. The driver's eyes bulged as I collapsed against his door. I sobbed.
Help me, please.
I woke up at the hospital 2 days later. The police took my statement, but their faces said that they didn't believe me. When they came back from the village, they shrugged.
No one by that name lives here,
they said.
The Karoviks moved away years ago.
But I know what I saw. And when I checked my phone, one lost photo had survived. A blurry selfie. My face half melted into Anna's. Now, when I look in the mirror too long, something looks back.